This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Let's dive into something that's been casting a shadow of doubt from day one over the Barry Morphew investigation. DNA evidence, specifically unidentified male DNA, found in Suzanne Morphew's car and on her bike helmet, discovered back during round one of this legal saga. Now, anytime there's DNA linked to convicted sex offenders, that throws up immediate red flags, especially in a high-stakes murder case like this. You can practically hear Barry's defense attorneys popping champagne when that piece of information surfaced. But before anyone declares victory or reasonable doubt, there's some circumstantial nuance that we have to unravel here. We're talking today with former FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer, who has decades of experience cutting through investigative clutter. She's going to help us understand exactly what investigators found, why this DNA isn't the smoking gun Barry's defense would love it to be, and how something initially alarming like DNA matches to known offenders could end up meaning next to nothing in the big picture. Why does this all matter so much? Because, as Jennifer Coffendaffer will tell us, jurors often latch onto details that sound dramatic on paper, but lose significance under scrutiny. DNA isn't always the rock-solid piece of evidence we assume it is, especially partial DNA, which could match not just a handful, but thousands of unrelated people. It's like claiming you identified someone by a shadow in bad lighting. It feels compelling at first, but the more you examine it, the blurrier it gets. Let's hear what Coffendaffer has to say about the impact this mysterious DNA could have on Barry Morphew's upcoming trial, and whether it's a lifeline for Barry's defense or just another investigative distraction. Let's talk about possible reasonable doubt here in the case of Barry Morphew. One of the big things that they have been pointing at, the defense of Barry Morphew, pointed at round one before everything went to hell, unidentified male DNA found in Suzanne's car, discovered, and it did kind of complicate the situation. And the male DNA matched up through the CODIS system to people who have been charged with sexual offenses of being offenders. That's a little odd to find that, like, on the helmet and in the car of this. What's your take on all of that?
Well, you're exactly right. And that's going to be where the defense hangs its hat, is this DNA. We're seeing it already in the Brian Koberger prosecution. Mm-hmm. We saw it mentioned related to John O'Keefe on his pants. So this is a big deal from the standpoint of the defense has something. And it looks bad, but let's consider what the FBI experts are saying about this DNA match. That a match just means there are some elements of that DNA, not very many, by the way, that match up to a lot of different people. So then they expanded on that and said, okay, well, how many of these people are even in the vicinity? And they did their investigation and showed that even if you were to believe, like you said kind of earlier, that the Yeti or Sasquatch or something was involved, they went and made sure, or not made sure, but verified that these other third parties were nowhere in the vicinity during the crime. So, you know, they used other investigative techniques to show it's not possible. But as you said, we've seen it before where a juror could just latch onto unknown DNA and just snow out all the other investigation that went on.
So is this a strain of DNA that very unreliable, I guess? I mean, so much with DNA, we think, okay, if it's a match. But this sounds like one that wasn't quite the perfect match. And I don't know the terminology off the top of my head to say this is, you know, 1,000% what it's going to be. We've heard other DNA cases, like in the Koberger case, where it's like, look, this is him, or it's like it's one in some octillion percent that it couldn't be. This strains of it matched up to different people in different places. They've been ruled out as even being possibly there. So what is this DNA? Why is it so? Why is this one finding out, turning out to be so unreliable?
Well, DNA relies on not inclusion, but exclusion. it's used to exclude, in the case of Brian Kober, as you mentioned, octillions, you know, more than anybody in the world, right?
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous number, right? So we know that it everybody's excluded, so it has to be Brian's. In this case, they weren't able to exclude everybody because they don't have a full compilation of the DNA. So imagine if you just have, say, with a fingerprint, you have a couple whirls or a couple loops. Well, you don't have the entirety of the fingerprint. So you're saying, okay, well, part of it matches these people, but they don't have the full full compilation of that DNA done, Tony. And the match expert, boy, I tell you, when you read his report, he explains it so well. I don't like that they use the word match, but that's just what they do scientifically, even if it means a little bit of a match or the whole match. So, you know, they scientifically, you have to at least consider it. But when you add the whole program together, it doesn't match up.
So not super solid in terms of identifying who it could be, because it through CODIS, yes, it matched these people who are in there or matched those specific type of strains, but it could match many people. I would imagine this matches a lot of people who are not in CODIS then as well, who are not convicted sexual offenders. These are just the ones that it matched up to. So not a very solid piece of DNA that was found in that vehicle, or multiple pieces that were found in that vehicle, but it still belongs to someone. Does it matter, though? It's a vehicle. And yes, obviously, she was found dead. But if we can't match this up to somebody, is there other ways of trying to see whose this is? Or does it matter in terms of the investigation? I would certainly think it matters to the defense of Barry, no matter what.
Well, I think the reason it doesn't matter was all the people that it partial matched to, they've excluded as being anywhere in the zip code during the commission of this crime. So it doesn't really matter that they can't figure out who it went back to. They weren't around anytime on May 9th or 10th, 2020. But I agree with you that this will be something that the defense continues to latch onto and try to develop.
If there wasn't enough DNA data in the DNA to do a solid match through CODIS, and I don't know if you know the answer to this question, but if they were to, if the defense were to try and put this into some sort of like a familial database to try and match up to relatives like we saw with Koberger or something of that nature, would there be enough to do that to find out, you know, who's in the general area who might be part of this, but who might have the DNA in the car? And it may mean absolutely nothing. It may mean it's somebody she went out coffee with and, you know, whatever, somebody who picked up her bike helmet on the ground one day. There's a lot of things it could be that are absolutely null, means nothing at all. But could they do that? Could they take a look at that and see if they find anything interesting?
Well, I don't think that I'm sure for familiarly, how do you say that?
Familiarly, yeah, it's a hard one.
It's a hard one. I think that that's not part of this DNA quote unquote match that they've discovered. It definitely, in the report I read, specifically outlined to a lot of different people, and then they narrowed that to three people that were in the region, and then they were able to exclude those individuals through all this investigation. So, unfortunately, Tony, I don't think we're going to be able to ever know exactly whose DNA that was. Can you imagine, and I've said this too in the Koberger case, how difficult it would be with literally hundreds of people going in and out of that house over those years, even before the kids lived there, right? It's on a banister that people touch all the time. It's just so difficult. You would have to get everybody's DNA, and not only is that cost prohibitive, it's really resource prohibitive. And so but the point is, to me, they took the only three possibilities in that region that it partially matched to and excluded them.
And that's a big thing. Well, that'll be argued. But again, how will the jury interpret it once it gets to trial, if we get to trial? Because again, charges are brand new here right now. We're going to see how this plays out. Very likely it will get there. Here's another big point, and I'm playing devil's advocate now just to see, what do you think of some of this? The fact that his two daughters, their mother's dead, they still stick by dad, at least as of now, at least as from what we've seen. They've been standing by dad through all of this, new charges against him. Obviously, it'd be a very difficult thing to try and wrap your mind around that dad may have killed mom in a fit of rage with a tranquilizer dart, but they're still there. And it's been many, many years now. Obviously, these new charges have come about, so we'll see where they stand now. But what does that say about this case, that even the daughters are not sitting there questioning any of this?
Well, we've seen it in so many cases where particularly children over sisters and parents and everything really stick by their family, by their father, for heaven's sakes. It's so hard to get your mind around. Not only do we not have our mother anymore, but our father could be responsible. I think it's something that no child would ever want to face or accept. And I don't know to the degree that they have sorted through that evidence, but my guess is who would ever want to do that as a child? So at least at this point, I think the children will continue to support him. I think the jury, if this goes to trial, which I think it will continue to, look at them. They'll be assessing him. They'll be assessing that his children are there. His children will likely testify on his behalf, even though they weren't there.
Yeah,
to be clear. They didn't come until the 10th, and they said, "Oh my gosh, here we are for Mother's Day, and Mom's not here."
Yeah,
and which, as you pointed out earlier, another piece that doesn't make sense. It made sense to me that Barry wasn't there, but for those girls, why would the mom be gone, initially on Mother's Day?
Yeah.
Big red light, flashing light there.
Yeah, rather bizarre. Another thing that kind of struck me about this, looking back on it, when all this broke just the other week, the fact that Barry filed that $15 million lawsuit alleging malicious prosecution, and it was ended up being thrown out of court. But if you did this, and they drop the charges against you, and you have the gall to file a $15 million wrongful prosecution lawsuit, that's quite a ballsy move, to put it bluntly, if you did it. That to me struck me as a little bit odd the whole time. I would think if you have absolutely nothing to hide, yeah, go ahead, file your lawsuit. But I think that would open up the door to a lot more discovery and possibilities. I know it's been thrown out, but he had the wherewithal to file it at one point in time. Is that the work of a guilty person?
Well, I think it's the work of somebody that is just continuing with the cover up and continuing with feigning innocence to his children and to everyone else, right? You don't want to be, just think of all the individuals that think he murdered her based on the initial indictment and all the information that was disclosed in that complaint, all those details that we're seeing again in this indictment in part. So even though you might have had charges dismissed, you still have a community and individuals who read that, and certainly in social media, everybody thinking you still did it. You might be free, might not be charged, but everybody thinks you did it. So what's that saying, Tony? The best defense is a good offense, right? So I think that that's how he was playing his cards. I think his daughters could have possibly, we don't know. But, family and friends saying, listen, they prosecuted you maliciously. You should go after them. And so I could see him saying, you're right. I'm going to do it.
And just so playing the role.
It doesn't surprise me. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically calling their bluff while you're bluffing. And quite the move. He does seem like a guy, from the little bit that we've seen, that he's, he's got a strong personality, and I think he's going to want make people believe what he wants them to believe. And it's probably worked out fairly well for most of his life. But this is going to be an interesting challenge here as this begins to roll on. I'm expecting we're going to hear probably he's going to plead not guilty. I don't know. He hasn't pled yet as of our recording, correct? This has happened on, I believe, Friday.
It happened on Friday, and the first hearing, of course, is the extradition hearing. He waived extradition, meaning he said, no problem, I'm going back to Colorado. Yep. And so he's there to face charges, so the transportation and so forth. Mm-hmm. But yeah, at arraignment, of course, he will plead not guilty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the fight's going to be on to the extent he has the money. And then it'll probably go to the public defender unless, you know, he decides to get a GoFundMe. I haven't looked to mm-hmm. see if he has one, and his daughters and everybody starts to try to rally behind his innocence and raise mm-hmm. money. We've seen that before. So, but I don't think he has a lot compared to the first time he had that beautiful home. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, he's purportedly living in a trailer. In fact, the owner of the trailer park was upset, calling everybody out. Listen, this isn't Barry Morphew's trailer park. This is mine. Mm-hmm. He's renting a trailer here. So lay off the, you know, discussion about my trailer park, which I found very interesting. So it leads me to wonder what his means are at this point.
Yeah, that that will play a big deal in this. Last time, I don't recall, what was the public perception on this? I mean, obviously, he's not a pretty woman from Massachusetts with a man named a Turtle backing him up. But some, I think, could look at this and go, well, there's enough evidence here that does not push it to beyond a reasonable doubt. Do you see that there's going to be a lot of public support for Barry this time around for his defense? Or is this one that is going to be more so in the line of, yeah, you probably did it, we're not getting behind you?
Yeah, you know, the groundswell in the true crime community is certainly not that he is innocent, mm-hmm. but, you know, we've seen it before. There's definitely a group. They seem to travel from case to case to case. And that group does everything they can to, you know, show any sort of doubt. I'm not even going to call it reasonable, but yeah. They wave the flag as if it's reasonable doubt throughout the, mm-hmm. you know, airwaves. So will this catch fire? I kind of doubt it. Even, you know, his picture, I don't know if you saw his booking photo. It looked like he literally aged 30 years.
He does, yeah.
It was something.
Yeah.
And he just doesn't come off as likable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think people truly feel for this victim, Suzanne Morphew,
mm-hmm.
20, 25 years, and we're just getting to substantial charges that are seemingly going to stick. So she's a very, you know, a victim that I think a lot of people can empathize with.
So here we are after unpacking this old DNA mess with Jennifer Coffendaffer. One thing is clear, forensic evidence is never as straightforward as TV dramas might lead you to believe. It's tempting, especially for the defense, to wave around unidentified male DNA and say, look, reasonable doubt served on a silver platter right here for you. But as Coffendaffer expertly explained, this DNA isn't a neat, tidy fingerprint pointing straight to another culprit. It is fragmented, incomplete, and frankly unreliable for solid identification. The FBI's painstaking efforts ruled out anyone in this area who even partially matched that mysterious DNA, leaving the defense clutching at straws. But let's be real. The courtroom is not a science lab, and juries are not forensic experts. The defense knows jurors might latch onto even the smallest uncertainty, like it's a lifeboat. This isn't a unique challenge. We've seen high-profile trials hinge on far less. Barry Morphew's defense doesn't have to prove he's innocent. They just have to sprinkle enough confusion to muddy the waters and plant those seeds of doubt. Then there's the emotional wild card, the fact that Barry's daughters, who lost their mother under incredibly suspicious circumstances, are still standing firmly by their dad. Is it loyalty? Denial? Something deeper? Either way, it's a powerful visual in the courtroom and something jurors inevitably will weigh, even subconsciously. As Jennifer pointed out, it's tough for anyone, especially adult kids, to wrap their heads around the idea that their own father might have committed such a horrific act. That's psychological territory nobody wants to explore, especially not the public in a public stage of a murder trial. Let's not overlook Barry's audacious move, filing that $15 million malicious prosecution lawsuit after his first charges collapsed. Guilty or innocent, that takes guts or almost an alarming level of denial. But as Coffendaffer put it perfectly, sometimes the best defense really is an aggressive offense. Barry played the cards boldly, once betting on prosecutorial missteps. With these fresh charges and stronger evidence emerging, that strategy might not work a second time. Bottom line, as this trial inches closer, the battle lines are clear. Barry's attorneys will weave this DNA like a banner. They're going to wave it hard into the case, shouting about reasonable doubt. The prosecution will calmly pick apart those claims piece by piece, pointing to investigative rigor and forensic clarity. And somewhere between the dramatic headlines and the meticulous science that lies the truth. A truth the jury ultimately will have to uncover. But will they? Tell me what you think in the comment section. Is there enough reasonable doubt here that Barry Morphew should not go to prison for the murder of his wife that he's alleged to have committed? Or is it pretty solid? Ultimately, a jury is going to understand. But what do you think? What do you think the evidence points to in this case? Tell me in the comments section on YouTube. And if you're listening to us on a podcast platform like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or iHeart, please hit subscribe there. But then also, please do check out our YouTube channel. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. You can see us doing the show. And you can weigh in with your opinion. We would love to hear it. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. Thank you guys for listening. We will talk again real soon.
Want true crime coverage all day, every day? Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today and get the latest cases delivered right to your feed.